Mr. Tomic swept into the room. He had the blue scrubs on, but this time wore a doctor's white coat over them. "Good morning, Claudia," he said, and he nodded at me. "How are you feeling?" "Much better than last night," Claudia replied. "But I'm rather sore." "Yes," he said, "that's normal. I had to make incisions in the abdominal wall. They were only small, but still painful. Do you think you're up to getting up?" "I have been," she said, almost in triumph. "I went to the loo last night and again this morning." "Good," he said. "And I think you can go home today. I'll see you in 10 days to check on everything and take out the stitches. Until then, take it easy." "Great," I said. "She will. I'll see to that. And," he went on, "we've had the first results from the tests."
"Yes," Claudia said. "You can tell me."
"The right ovary seems clear, but as I feared, there were some cancer cells in the peritoneal fluid. Not many, but enough." We were all silent for a moment.
"Chemotherapy," Claudia said.
"I'm afraid so," said Mr. Tomic. "But maybe just one course, two at most. I'm sorry, but it's the best way forward." He left us digesting that not-so-tasty morsel, rushing off, no doubt, to cut out bits from another desperate cancer patient. It was not my idea of a fun job.
"Let's look on the bright side, my darling," I said finally. "The right ovary is clear."
"That's true," Claudia replied, trying to be a little enthusiastic.
"So we might still have kids," I said.
"If the chemo doesn't make me infertile," she replied gloomily. Even the thought of being discharged from hospital didn't cheer her up much, especially when I told her we weren't going home, but to my mother's house in Gloucestershire.
"Nick, you've got to be kidding," were her exact words.
"Nope," I said, "and Mum is so looking forward to it."
"But I want to go home," Claudia whined. "I want my own bed."
"But how would I look after you there when I have to go to work tomorrow? And how, pray," she asked dryly, "are you going to go to work tomorrow from Cheltenham?" She paused briefly. "Come on, Nick, please, let's just go home." Now, what could I say? I could hardly tell her I was worried we might get murdered on our own doorstep. She probably wouldn't have believed me anyway. I was convinced that Lichfield Grove was far too dangerous for us, and there was no way I was knowingly going to place my new fiancé into jeopardy. I'd been lucky last time, very lucky, and I'd had to run for my life. There was no way that Claudia would be able to run after having had 2 incisions through her abdominal wall, and who is to say I'd be lucky again? And to live, I had to be lucky every time. My best chance, surely, was to be where the assassin wouldn't be, and to remain where he couldn't find me. He only had to be lucky once. So, I decided, returning to Lichfield Grove was completely out of the question.
"My mother is so looking forward to it," I said. "And you yourself said it would be nice to go down to see her after the operation."
"Yes," she replied, "but I didn't mean straight from the hospital."
"Oh, come on, darling," I pleaded. "If your mother was still alive, we would probably go and stay with her."
It was a low blow, well beneath the belt, and to someone who was in no state to receive one. We rarely, if ever, spoke of Claudia's parents. They had left her, aged 8, to spend the day with her grandmother, but they'd never come back. Their Ford Escort had been driven off the cliff at Beachy Head straight down to the shingle beach some 500 feet below. The inquest had apparently returned a misadventure verdict rather than one of suicide. There had been some doubt as to which of the two had been driving at the time, or whether some malfunction of the car had been the cause. But either way, Claudia blamed them both absolutely for leaving her alone in the world. I thought it was quite likely the true reason behind all her weird paintings, but it was a topic that I raised rarely, and then with great care and tact.
"Nick, that's hardly fair," she said crossly.
"I'm sorry," I said,
"but I do want us to go straight to Mum's." "But what about my things?" she said.
"You've got many of them here with you," I said, "and I collected a few more yesterday from home."
"And I definitely can't go to your mother's without my makeup," she said defiantly.
"I've collected that too," I said, trying not to sound too triumphant. We went to my mother's, but not before I'd received another tongue-lashing over my extravagance in hiring a car for the trip.
"And what's wrong with our Mercedes?" Claudia had asked angrily.
"I thought you'd rather have a bit more space after your op," I said, all sweetness and light. "The SLK is so cramped for the passenger." And rather conspicuous, I thought. The man at the Hertz car rental centre had tried to get me to hire his car of the week, a bright yellow Audi convertible with shiny chrome wheels. "It would suit you, sir," he said eagerly. "Your sort of colour makes a big statement."
I had opted instead for a bog-standard four-door blue saloon with not so much as a go-faster stripe down the side. I wanted to blend into the background, not stand out from it. I'd make my big statement in another way. I'd told Claudia that my mother was looking forward to having a stay, and she was, but only after I had talked her out of going to her regular Wednesday afternoon whist drive in the village. "Mum," I'd said on the telephone, having woken her at 10 to 7 in the morning, "I just need to get us away for a few days." "But why, darling?" she'd replied. "What's so sudden that you can't come tomorrow?" "Please, Mum," I said to her in a tone like a 7-year-old trying to get his reluctant parent to buy him a coveted toy. "Oh, all right," she said, "but I'll have to go shopping for some food, and I really don't like letting down the other players." "They'll understand," I'd said. "Just tell them your son is coming and bringing his fiancée home for the first time." She hadn't been able to speak for a few moments. I had waited. "Oh, darling," she'd said eventually, her voice full of emotion, "is it really true, or are you just saying that?" "It's really true," I'd replied. Hence, when we drove down the lane to her cottage, my mother was already outside to welcome us in tears and almost unable to speak with joy. She hugged Claudia like she'd never done so before. "What did you say to her?" Claudia asked me quietly as we went inside. "I told her we were engaged," I said. "We are, aren't we?" "Yes," she said, smiling. "Of course we are. But what else did you tell her? You know, about the cancer?"
"Nothing," I said. "I'll leave that for you to decide."
"I think not," she said. "Not yet."
"Fine," I replied.
We went into the open-plan kitchen diner lounge, and Claudia sat down gingerly on a chair. "What's the matter, my dear?" my mother asked with concern. "You look like you're in pain."
"I am, Dorothy," Claudia said. "I've just had an operation, a hernia, but I'll be fine soon."
"My dear," said my mother, "come at once and put your feet up on the sofa." She fussed around her future daughter-in-law like a brooding mother hen, and soon had Claudia propped up on a chintz-covered sofa with multiple pillows.
"There," my mother said, standing back. "How about a nice cup of tea?"
"That would be lovely," Claudia said, and she winked at me.
I left them to their bonding session, while I took our things upstairs to the guest bedroom, negotiating the narrow, twisting staircase with our bags. I sat on the bed and called the office using my mother's cordless phone. Gregory should have returned from his long weekend away by now, and with luck, Patrick would have convinced him over lunch not to hang, draw, and quarter me, even perhaps to let me back into the offices. Mrs. McDowd answered.
"Alan Black," she said in her usual crisp tone. "How can I direct your call?"
"Hello, Mrs. McDowd," I said. "Mr. Nicholas here."
"Ah, yes," she said curtly. "Mr. Patrick said you might ring, but it's not your number."
Mrs. McDowd, I decided, was sitting on the fence with regards to me. She was being neither friendly nor hostile towards me. She would clearly wait to see how I fared with the senior partners before committing an allegiance either way.
"Are Mr. Patrick and Mr. Gregory back from lunch yet?" I asked. "They didn't go to lunch," she said. "They've gone to a funeral. They'll be gone for the rest of the day."
That was rather sudden, I said.
"Death often is," she replied.
"Whose funeral is it?" I asked.
"A client of Gregory's," she said. "Someone called Roberts. Colonel Jolyon Roberts."
Chapter 13.
"What?" I said.
"What did you say?"
"Colonel Jolyon Roberts," Mrs. McDowd said again. "Mr. Patrick and Mr. Gregory have gone to his funeral."
"But when did he die?" I asked. "I've been talking to him only on Saturday at Sandown Park Races."
"Seems he was found dead early yesterday morning," she said. "Heart attack, apparently. Very sudden."
"The funeral is mighty sudden, too," I said, "if he only died yesterday."
"Jewish," she said by way of explanation. "Quick burial is part of their culture, and usually within 24 hours. Something to do with the heat in Israel."
She was a mine of information, Mrs. McDowd. The heat in England in April isn't quite as intense as that in a Jerusalem summer, but I suppose traditions are traditions. And I never realised that Jolly and Roberts had been Jewish, but why should I?
"Are you sure it was a heart attack?" I asked her.
Never mind the chief inspector's suspicious mind, I thought. Mine was now in overdrive.
"That's what I heard from Mr. Gregory," said Mrs. McDowd. "He was quite shocked by it. Seems he'd only been talking to Colonel Roberts on Monday afternoon."
"I thought Mr. Gregory was away for a long weekend."
"He was meant to be," she said, "but he came back on Monday. Something urgent cropped up."
"Okay," I said. "I'll call Mr. Patrick on his mobile."
"The funeral service is at 3, she said.
I looked at my watch.
It was well past 2:30.
"I won't call him till afterwards," I said. "Where is it?"
"Golders Green," she said, "at the Jewish cemetery in the family plot."
I disconnected and sat on the bed for a while, thinking. Herb Kovac had accessed the Roberts Family Trust file and the Bulgarian investment details, and within a week of doing so, he'd been murdered. I'd sent an innocent-looking email to a man in Bulgaria about the same development, and 4 days later, someone turned up on my doorstep trying to kill me. And now, Jolyon Roberts, with his questions and doubts about the whole Bulgarian project, conveniently dies of a heart attack the day after speaking to Gregory about it, as I had told him he should? Was I going crazy? Or was a pattern beginning to appear? €100 million of EU money was a lot of cash. Was it enough to murder for? Was it enough to murder 3 times for? I decided to call Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson, if only to try and get some more information about the death of Jolyon Roberts.
"Are you suggesting that this Colonel Roberts was murdered?" he asked in a sceptical tone.
Suddenly the whole idea appeared less plausible. "I don't know," I said, "but I'd love to hear what the pathologist said."
"Assuming there was an autopsy."
"Surely there would be," I said. "I thought all sudden deaths were subject to postmortems."
"But why do you believe he was murdered?"
"I'm probably wrong," I said.
"Tell me anyway," the chief inspector said with a degree of encouragement, "and I promise not to laugh."
"Murder is pretty uncommon, right?"
"I've seen more than my fair share on Merseyside."
"But generally," I said, "for us non-homicide detectives, I'd say it was a pretty rare thing to know a murder victim, wouldn't you agree?"
"Okay, I agree. Murder is uncommon."
"Well," I said, "if I'm right, and Colonel Roberts was murdered, then I've known 2 murder victims, and both of them have been killed within the past 2 weeks, and I nearly became the third." I paused.
"Go on," he said.
"So I looked to see what connection Herb Kovac had with Colonel Roberts, and also with myself."
"Yes,"
he said with greater eagerness. "Lyle and Black, for one thing," I said. "Herb Kovac and I work for the firm, and Colonel Roberts was a client, although not a client that Herb or I would usually have contacted." I paused. "But Herb accessed the Roberts file just 10 days before he died, in particular looking at the details of a Bulgarian investment that the Roberts Family Trust had made. I saw the record of him having done so on a company computer."
"And what is significant about that?" the detective asked.
"Colonel Roberts approached me just a week ago over his concerns about that very same investment."
"Why did he approach you in particular?"
"I'm not really sure," I said. "He knew I worked for Lyle and Black, and he met me at the races on Tuesday and again on Wednesday. It was a chance meeting the first time. But I'm sure it was on purpose the second day. He was worried that the factory he had invested in hadn't actually been built, as he'd been told it had. But he didn't want a full inquiry, as he was worried that he'd been duped, and he didn't want the whole world to know. So he asked me to quietly have a look and check that all was well with the investment."
"And did you?" he asked.
"I did a little bit of digging, but I told him on Saturday that I couldn't go searching behind the backs of the others at the firm, and he should speak to his investment manager about it."
"Who is?"
he asked. "Gregory Black," I said. "Colonel Roberts spoke to him on Monday, only the day before he died."
"But it's quite a jump to think that he was murdered because of it. And are you telling me you suspect Gregory Black of killing him?"
"No, of course not," I said. "Gregory Black may have an explosive temper, but he's hardly a murderer." Or was he? Could I really tell what went on in his head? Or in anyone else's head, for that matter? But Gregory a murderer? Surely not. "But that's not all," I said. "I sent an email to someone in Bulgaria last Friday, and a would-be assassin turned up at my door on Tuesday afternoon."
"Okay," he said, now firmly interested. "I'll try and find out if there was an autopsy carried out on this Colonel Roberts. Where did you say he lived?"
"Hampstead," I said. "He only died yesterday, and he's being buried in Golders Green Cemetery even as we speak."
"That's very quick," he said.
"Apparently it's a Jewish tradition to bury the dead as quickly as possible."
"At least it's not a cremation," he said. "No chance of a second look at the body if it's cremated." "And I speak from experience," he laughed.
What a strange occupation, I thought. Daily dealings with violent death and its fallout.
"You will let me know the results?" I asked. "If I can," he said. "I'll call you if I get anything."
"I'm not at home, and my mobile doesn't work where I am."
"And where is that?"
I was a little reluctant to tell him. The fewer people who knew, the safer I'd feel, but he was the police, and he had provided me with an unshakable alibi when I was arrested for attempted murder.
"I'm in a village called Woodmancote," I said. "It's near Cheltenham Racecourse. It's where my mother lives."
I gave him my mother's telephone number.
"Cheltenham's a long way from your office," he said, in a tone that seemed to ask a question.
I know," I said. "I ran away. Superintendent Euring was unable to provide me with any protection, and I felt very vulnerable. So I didn't go home."
"Can't say I really blame you," he said.
"So how about you giving me a bodyguard?" I asked. "Preferably one bristling with guns and with evil intent towards assassins."
"I'll see what I can do," he said. "Especially if it does turn out that Colonel Roberts was murdered."
"And another thing," I said, deciding to get my requests in quickly, as the chief inspector seemed to be in a generous mood. "Can you find out whether Billy Searle has started talking to the Wiltshire police, and what he's told them? Do you think he has something to do with all this as well?"
"No, I don't," I said. "I happen to know where Billy's money was invested because I manage his portfolio, and it was nowhere near Bulgaria. I'm just interested to know what he's told the police. After all, I was arrested on suspicion of trying to kill him."
"I'll try," he said, "but some of these rural detectives can be reluctant to discuss their cases with officers from other forces."
"Just remind them it was me who gave them the information that Billy Searle owed someone $100,000, and it was you that stopped them from looking bloody foolish by charging me with attempted murder when I had a cast-iron alibi."
"Okay, okay. I said I'd try."
When I went downstairs, my mother and Claudia were in full flow with wedding plans.
"It was about time he asked you to marry him," she said to Claudia while looking at me.
"But he didn't," Claudia replied. "I asked him." My mother was quite taken aback and even rendered speechless for a few seconds. She had always been a stickler for tradition.
"How very unusual," she said finally. "But Nicholas always was a funny boy."
Jan Setter had called me strange. Was I really funny or strange? I didn't think so. To me, I was normal, but I suppose everyone thinks they're normal, and yet we are all so different. There was actually no such thing as normal.
"Now, darlings," my mother said, changing the subject, "would you like some late lunch? I have a shepherd's pie in the oven."
"Mum," I said, "it's gone 3 o'clock."
"So," she replied, "I thought you might be hungry when you arrived."
Surprisingly, I was, and I could tell from Claudia's eager look that she was too. I had been so busy trying to make the journey smooth and jerk-free to keep Claudia as comfortable as possible that I hadn't even thought of stopping for food. Consequently, the three of us sat down to a very late lunch of shepherd's pie and broccoli, with my mother insisting that I had a second helping. I called Patrick on his mobile at 5:40, late enough for the funeral to be over, but early enough for it still to be in the working day. Claudia was upstairs having a rest, and my mother was busying herself by the stove, preparing yet another high-fat, high-protein chicken casserole for our dinner. I sat on the chintz sofa in the lounge area, facing her, but at the furthest point of the room.
"Ah, yes, Nicholas," Patrick said, seeming slightly flustered. "Mrs. McDowd told me you'd called. Sorry I wasn't able to speak to you earlier."
"And I'm sorry to hear about Colonel Roberts," I said.
"Yes, what a dreadful thing. He was only 62 as well. Enjoy life while you've got it, that's what I say. You never know when the Grim Reaper will catch you up."
"Yes," I thought, "but I'd outrun him once down Litchfield Grove."
"Have you spoken to Gregory?" I asked, getting to the point of the call.
"Yes, I have," he said. "He's still very angry with you."
"But why?" I asked.
"Why do you think," he said crossly, "for getting arrested and being splashed all over the papers and the television? He believes you brought the firm into disrepute."
"But, Patrick, his anger is completely misplaced, and he is wrong. It wasn't my fault that I was arrested. The police jumped to a conclusion, and it was an incorrect one."
"Yes," he said, "but you did give them reason to draw it."
"I did not," I said, getting quite angry myself. "It was that idiot Billy Searle who shouted out about murder. I did absolutely nothing wrong."
My mother glanced over at me from the kitchen area.
"Gregory says there is no smoke without fire. He still thinks you must have had something to do with it."
"Well, in that case, Gregory is more of an idiot than I thought."
My raised voice caused my mother to stand and look at me from across the room, and with a furrowed brow. I paused to calm myself down. I then spoke much more quietly. "Am I being fired? Because if I am, I'll be taking Lyle and Black to court." He did not reply, and I stayed silent. I could hear his breathing.
"You had better come into the office tomorrow," he said at last. "I will tell Gregory to hold his tongue."
"Thank you," I said.
"But I may not make it in tomorrow. Claudia is not very well, and I'll probably work from home using the remote access system. I hope to see you on Friday."
"Right,"
he said, sounding slightly relieved that he had at least another day to dampen the erupting Gregory volcano.
I'll see you on Friday.
He hung up, and I sat for a while wondering about my future, if I still had one, with a gun-toting assassin on the loose. What was all that about? My mother asked with concern. Oh, nothing, Mum, I said, just a little problem at work, nothing to worry about. But I did worry about it. I had really enjoyed working for Lyle and Black over the last 5 years, but the role of an independent financial advisor was one that necessitated absolute trust, both of the client and of one's colleagues. What sort of future did I have in a firm where one of the senior partners believed me to be involved in an attempted murder, and at the same time, I wondered if he had been involved in a successful one? The three of us sat at my mother's dining table for dinner, and I ate and drank too much for my own good. "What's happened to your cat?" I asked, noticing its absence from under the table. "It's not my cat," my mother said. "He's just an irregular visitor, and I haven't seen him for days. He'll probably be back sometime soon." No doubt when fillet steak was back on the menu, I thought. Claudia and I went up to bed early for us, around 10 o'clock. "You are such a clever thing," Claudia said to me as we snuggled up together under the duvet. "In what way?" I asked. "Insisting we came here," she said. "If we'd gone home, I would have felt pressured to cook or clean or do something useful. Here I can relax completely. My phone doesn't even ring, and your mother is such a dear." I smiled in the darkness. Now, that was a turn-up. "But we can't stay here very long," I said seriously. "Why not?" she asked. "Because if she goes on feeding me as she's done today, I'll end up with a waistline like Homer Simpson's." We giggled uncontrollably. Since we'd left the hospital that morning, neither of us had mentioned anything about the cancer or the upcoming chemo treatments. It was as if we had left all our troubles behind, in London. But they were about to come looking for us. I dreamed that I was riding in a race, but like all dreams, it was inconsistent and erratic. One second I was on a horse, the next on an ostrich, or in a car. However, one part of the dream was unvarying. Whatever we were riding, I was always racing against Gregory, and he was ever smiling and aiming a gun with a silencer at my head. I woke up with a jerk, breathing fast, ready to run. I relaxed and lay there in the dark, listening to Claudia's rhythmic breathing beside me. Did I really think that Gregory Black was involved in fraud and murder? I didn't know. But I was sure interested to hear the results of the post-mortem examination on Jolyon Roberts, if there had been one. I drifted back to sleep, but only fitfully, waking often to listen for sounds that shouldn't have been there. Woodmancote was much quieter without traffic, and much darker without street lamps than our home in Lichfield Grove, but nevertheless, I slept badly, and was wide awake long before the sun lit up the bedroom window soon after 6 o'clock. I got up quietly, and padded silently downstairs in bare feet with my computer. I had been seriously neglecting my clients over the past 2 weeks, and if I didn't pull my finger out soon, I'd have no job worthy of the name at Lyle and Black to cry about, even if I was fired. I logged onto the internet. I had 43 unread emails, including a fresh one from Jan Setter, telling me how fantastic the first night of the Florence Nightingale show had been, and how crazy I was to have missed it. It was timed at 5:50 a.m. this morning, and the show in London hadn't finished until 10:30 last night, not to mention how late the after-show party had gone on. Did she never sleep? Or had she sent it as soon as she'd arrived home? I emailed back to her and said how pleased I was she had enjoyed it, and how I hoped it would make her lots of money. Then I went onto the daily newspaper websites to read the reviews. All but one were pretty encouraging, so maybe the show might make some money. Backing shows and films was always a risky business. I usually told my clients that it was far more of a gamble than they would have on the stock market, but as with most risky investments, the potential gains were greater too. But they had to be prepared to lose all their money. One of my clients never expected any financial return from such investments. He just reveled in rubbing shoulders with the stars at the first night functions and taking all his friends to see his show in the best seats. "I know I might lose it all," he would say, "but if I do, I'll enjoy every minute while I'm losing it. And you never know, I might just make a fortune." And he had done precisely that the previous year. At my suggestion, he had backed a small independent film company to make an obscure and irreverent comedy based around the first transportation of convicts from England to Australia in 1787. To everyone's surprise, not least my clients,
the film had been a huge international hit. At the box office worldwide, it had earned back over 200 times its production cost, as well as receiving an Oscar nomination for its young star, who played the title role in Bruce, the First Australian. But the successes were few, and the disasters many. It took me over 2 hours just to answer my outstanding emails, by which time I could hear movement above, and presently my mother came downstairs in her dressing gown. "Hello, dear," she said, "you're up early."
"I've been down here over 2 hours," I said. "I have work to do."
"Yes, dear," she said, "don't we all? Now, what would you like for breakfast? I have some bacon and local eggs, and Mr. Ayres, my butcher, has made me some wonderful sausages. How many would you like?"
"Just a coffee and a slice of toast would be lovely," I said.
It was like King Canute trying to hold back the tide.
"Don't be ridiculous," she said, already placing a frying pan on the stove. "You've got to have a proper breakfast. What sort of mother would I be if I didn't feed you?"
I sighed. Perhaps Claudia and I would go out for a drive at lunchtime. I took her up a cup of tea while the sausages and bacon were sizzling in the pan. "Morning, gorgeous," I said, pulling open the curtains. "How are you feeling today?"
"Still a bit sore," she said, sitting up, "but better than yesterday."
"Good," I said. "Time to get up. Delia Smith downstairs is cooking breakfast."
"Mmm, I can smell it," she said, laughing. "Now, don't you expect that every morning when we're married?"
"What?" I said in mock horror. "No cooked breakfast? The wedding's off."
"We haven't even fixed a date for it yet," she said.
"Before or after the hair loss?" I asked seriously. She thought for a moment.
"After it grows back. Give me time to get used to this engagement business first."
"After it is, then," I said. I leaned down and kissed her. "Don't be long, or Mr. Eyre's sausages will get cold." She dived back under the covers and put a pillow over her head.
"I'm staying here. Hiding won't help," I said, laughing, and leaving her alone.
My mother hadn't lied. The sausages were excellent, but as always with her meals, they were too big and too numerous. And then there was the mountain of bacon and the scrambled eggs on fried bread, not forgetting the mushrooms and grilled tomatoes on the side. I felt totally bloated by the time I sat down again at my computer to check through my client files using the firm's remote access facility. Claudia, meanwhile, had managed to extract herself from her bed, coming down to join us in a bathrobe, but she ate just a small bowl of muesli and a little sliced fruit and had grinned at me as she did so. It really wasn't fair. I spent the morning briefly looking through all the files for my 50 or so personal clients to check on the reminder tags, ensuring that I hadn't missed reinvesting the proceeds of maturing bonds or such like. What I really needed to do was to study all the recent stock movements. It was something that I should be doing every day in order to maintain a feel for the markets, to try and be, if not one step ahead, at least in tune with market trends. Not that Lyle and Black invested directly in individual stocks. That proportion of our clients' money put into equities was almost exclusively invested through unit trusts or investment funds that had a broad range of different shares within them. It was a way of spreading risk, of placing one's eggs in many baskets at the same time. But it was still important for me to have a feel for the markets in order to advise my clients which of the hundreds of trusts and funds to buy into. And over the past week or so, I had been guilty of serious dereliction of my duty in the study department. I used my mother's landline to check on my voicemail. There was one new message, and it was from Sherry asking me to call her at Herb's flat. "Hi," I said when she answered. "Is everything all right?"
"Fine," she replied, sounding totally fed up. "Least I suppose it's fine. Monday in Liverpool was a bit of an ordeal."
"I'm sorry," I said.
"Yeah," she said. "Well, it's over anyway."
She sighed audibly down the phone.
"I'm going home tomorrow morning. I'm on a flight at 10:45 to Chicago. I just called to say goodbye."
"Thanks," I said. "I'm glad you did."
"A few letters have arrived here for Herb, and I had a phone call from his gym. Something about Herb not paying them, and they want his locker back. Hold on, I've got their number somewhere."
I could hear her rummaging in the background.
"Here it is. Somewhere called the Slim Fit Gym."
She read out the telephone number, and I jotted it down on the back of the rental car agreement.
"Don't you worry," I said. "Leave the letters on the desk. I'll deal with them, and I'll call the gym. You look after yourself."
I hope you have a safe trip home. I'll let you know about the funeral and such when I know myself.
The police said it could be weeks away. That's why I'm going back. I'll lose my job if I stay here much longer.
Life could be a bugger. I called the slim fit Jim.
Mr. Comac's direct debit has been cancelled, someone said, so we want his locker back.
He died, I said, so take it back.
But there's a padlock on it, the person said.
Well, don't you have a spare key, I asked.
It was Mr. Comac's own padlock.
Well, can't you cut it off, I said somewhat impatiently.
No,
the person was getting quite agitated. We must have the key. I remembered the one that was pinned to the notice board above Herb's desk.
Okay, I said, I'll bring it in next week.
They didn't like it, but it was too bad. However, they did insist on having my contact details. I hated giving out my mobile number, so I gave them the office one instead. I disconnected and leaned back in the chair, stretching.
Do you fancy going out? Claudia said, coming over and rubbing my shoulders. It's a lovely day out there.
My studying would have to wait.
That would be nice, I said, turning round on the chair. But are you sure you're feeling up to it?
Absolutely, she said. I'm feeling much better today.
But let's take the car. I'm not yet ready to yomp around the countryside. Why don't we go to a pub for lunch?
She winked at me.
Great idea, I agreed.
I stood up and went into the kitchen area where my mother was fussing with the dishwasher. Mum, I said to her, Claudia and I thought we might drive to a pub for lunch. Do you want to come?
Oh, she said. I have some nice pork chops from Mr. Eyre's for lunch.
Won't they do for this evening? I said. I've got a roast leg of lamb for us tonight.
Mr. Eyre's had obviously been busy.
Leave the chops in the fridge, I said. Give yourself a rest. Let's all go out for lunch.
And we did, with me looking over the hedge for my would-be assassin as the three of us climbed into the nondescript blue saloon. But, of course, he wasn't there, and we made it safely to a local country pub with a big good food sign outside. Claudia and my mother both ordered a glass of white wine and a poached salmon salad, while I just had a Diet Coke and a bag of roasted peanuts.
But, darling, my mother complained bitterly, you must have a proper lunch or you'll fade away.
Mother dear, I said, I've done nothing but eat since we arrived. I think fading away is the least of my worries. But she didn't like it, and I could already feel an extra large portion of lamb coming on for dinner. The phone was ringing when we arrived back at the cottage, and my mother rushed in to answer it. It's for you, she said, handing over the phone to me. Hello, I said.
It was definitely a heart attack, said Chief Inspector Tomlinson down the line, while he was swimming in his own pool. Then he drowned as a result. A full post-mortem was carried out at the Royal Free Hospital on Tuesday afternoon. Seems Colonel Roberts had a history of heart problems.
Oh, I said. Such are the perils of early morning swimming.
It was late night swimming, apparently, and on his own. And he'd been drinking, stupid fool. His blood alcohol level was more than twice that for drunk driving.
But he wasn't driving, I said.
No, said the detective, but he was swimming. And in my experience, alcohol and water don't mix.
He laughed at his own joke, and I found it slightly irritating. But it reminded me of Johnny and Roberts doing just the same thing during our meeting in the Chasers Bar at Sandown Park Races.
Hold on a minute,
I said, suddenly remembering something else from that meeting.
Colonel Roberts told me categorically that he didn't drink alcohol. And that he never had.
Chapter 14.
I'll get back to you, said Chief Inspector Tomlinson suddenly. I need to call in a few favours.
He hung up, and I was cross I hadn't asked him about Billy Searle. But it would wait. The phone rang again in my hand.
Hello, I said, answering it. Did you forget something?
Sorry, said a female voice.
Is that you, Mr. Nicholas?
Mrs. McDowd, I said. How lovely to hear from you.
There was a slight pause at the other end as Mrs. McDowd worked out that I was being sarcastic.
I have a message from Mr. Patrick, she said.
How did you get this number, I asked.
He wants you to...
She started, but I interrupted her. Mrs. McDowd, I said again loudly, how did you get this number?
It was on caller ID when you called in this morning,
she said. That was rather careless, I thought, for someone meant to be in hiding.
Anyway, she said, I know that number. You're staying with your mother. How is she?
Bloody Mrs. McDowd, I thought. How does she know so much about me?
She's fine, thank you, I said, biting my tongue. Now, what does Mr. Patrick want?
He wants you to call him in the morning before you come into the office. Something about arranging a meeting between you and Mr. Gregory.
Did he say what the meeting was about? I asked.
No, she said.
But I bet she knew. Mrs. McDowd knew everything.
Please tell Mr. Patrick that I won't be in the office very early tomorrow.
I've already told him that, she said, not with you being down in Gloucestershire.
Who else had she told, I wondered. In particular, had she told Mr. Gregory?
I spent much of the afternoon catching up on the changing price of derivatives and futures, and how a recent fall in the Dow Jones Index in the United States had affected markets in the Far East more than those in Europe, and on fluctuations in the value of gold in pounds as a result of changes in the cost of a barrel of oil in dollars. It was like a balancing act. Some economies grew, and others contracted. Stock markets moved at different paces or in opposite ways. Some currencies went up and others went down. The trick to winning in the great global financial game was to invest in the things about to go up in real value while selling those about to go down. Then there were the hedge funds and short selling, both designed to make you money when the values went in the wrong direction. But it was all a bit like gambling with a bookmaker. For you to win, he had to lose. So it was in the markets. There were winners and losers. The winners had big houses, and the losers went bust, losing their big houses to the banks, which then sold them to the winners. The money went round and round, but it did not always end up with the same people. And then there were the fraudsters, those who tried to load the odds in their favour through insider dealing or market manipulation. Once upon a time, insider dealing had been seen as a perk of the job for stockbrokers and company directors, cashing in on prior knowledge of profits and mergers by buying or selling stock before the facts were known to others. Nowadays, the courts send them to jail for doing what everyone used to do, and quite rightly too. But there are always those who think they can beat the system, and many of them do, because betting on a certainty was like having a license to print money. Herb Kovac had said to Mrs. McDowd that he liked to bet on certainties. She told me. Chief Inspector Tomlinson called back at 5 o'clock.
He'd definitely been drinking, he said. I've seen the full autopsy report. There's no mistake. They tested both his blood and the aqueous humour in his eye, and the stomach contained whiskey residue.
How easy is it to force someone to drink whiskey? I asked.
My, my, he said. Now who has the suspicious mind?
It's just too convenient, I said.
But how could you give someone a heart attack?
He asked in a slightly sarcastic tone, clearly indicating that he didn't believe me.
Hold his drunken head under the surface of his own swimming pool, I said. Either he drowns straight away, or, as he has a history of heart problems, he panics, has a heart attack, and then drowns.
But why the alcohol?
He asked. To add confusion, I said. When you knew he'd been drinking, you instinctively believed he had been a stupid fool, and you probably thought he half deserved to die for it.
True, he said. I did. But you're only speculating, and there's no evidence of foul play.
No, I agreed. And what there was has conveniently been buried in Golders Green Cemetery.
He laughed. Story of my life.
What about Billy Searle? I asked. What did you find out?
He's wide awake and talking, he said, but he's not saying anything.
Nothing?
Pretty much. He refuses to say if he knew the person who knocked him off his bike. Says it was an accident. And he denies owing anyone any money.
I wasn't surprised. If it was a bookmaker and Billy was involved in some betting scandal, he was hardly likely to admit it. It would be tantamount to handing in his jockey's license for good.
Well, thanks for finding out for me, I said. Any news on the gunman? Nothing as yet.
Didn't you get any response from the video?
Masses, he said. Too much, really. The Met and us are sifting through it all and cross-referencing with the Criminal Records Bureau.
That was what worried me the most. If he were a professional hitman, he was unlikely to have a criminal record, so he would never turn up from their cross-reference.
So how about that bodyguard you promised me? I asked. I can't stay down here for long, as it's too far from London, but I don't fancy going home with our friends still out there. I'll talk to my super, he said.
Thanks, I said, and please make it soon. We disconnected and I looked at my watch. It was 5:15, time to finish for the day. I leaned back in the chair and pushed the Get Mail button for a final check on my emails. One arrived from Gregory Black. I sat forward quickly and opened it.
Nicholas, he had written, Patrick has asked me to write you to apologise for my outburst of last Friday, so I am sorry.
I can also assure you there'll be no repetition of my actions when you return to this office after your stay with your mother. Yours, Gregory Black.
Wow, I thought. My threat of court action had really put the cat amongst the pigeons. I could imagine Gregory absolutely hating having to write that email with Patrick standing over him on one side and almost certainly with Andrew Meller, the company's lawyer, on the other, advising them both on employment law. I may have received a grudging apology from Gregory, but he would resent it forever, and it wouldn't make my future at the firm any easier. I also didn't like the fact that Gregory knew that I was staying with my mother. Mrs. McDowd not only wanted to know everything about everyone, she also liked them to know she knew it by spreading the information. The whole office would now be aware that I was in Gloucestershire and probably half of Lombard Street too. At about 7:30, my mother insisted I open a bottle of champagne to properly celebrate Claudia's and my engagement. I put one in my old fridge last night, she said, so it should be nice and cold. And it was. I retrieved the bottle and poured three glasses of the golden bubbly liquid, then we each in turn made a toast. To a long and happy marriage to my Claudia, I said, and we drank. To long life and good health, Claudia said, looking at me. We drank again. To masses of grandchildren, my mother said, and we all drank once more. Claudia and I held hands. We knew without saying what we were each thinking. Oh yes, please, to all three of the above, but with cancer, it was all so scary and unpredictable. Have you told your father yet? My mother asked. No, I said. You're the only person that knows. Not even Mrs. McDowd, I thought, knew this little secret. Aren't you going to tell him? Mum asked. Eventually, I said. But I haven't spoken much to him recently. Stupid man, she said. I knew she blamed him for the breakup of their marriage, but in truth, it had been as much her fault as his, but I didn't want to get into all that again. I'll call him tomorrow, I said. Let's enjoy our own company here tonight. I'll drink to that, said Claudia, raising her glass. So we did. I thought about my father. 7 years ago, when my parents had finally divorced and the big house had been sold, he'd taken his share of the money and used it to buy a boring bungalow in Weymouth overlooking the sea. I'd only been there a couple of times since, although I'd seen him a few times in London for various functions. We hadn't been very close to start with, and we were drifting further apart day by day. But I don't think it was something that bothered either of us particularly. He hadn't even called me when I'd been arrested and my face had been splashed all over the papers and on the TV. Perhaps my impending marriage and the possibility of grandchildren might help to revitalize our relationship. But I doubted it. Claudia laid the dining table as my mother busied herself with saucepans of potatoes and carrots, and the lamb roasted away gently in the oven. I, meanwhile, poured us all more champagne and let them get on with it, leaning up against the worktop and enjoying the last of the evening sunshine as it shone brightly through the west-facing kitchen window. Bugger, my mother said. What's wrong? I asked. The cooker's gone off, she said. Is it a power cut? She tried a light switch, clicking it up and down. Nothing happened. Bloody electricity company, she said. I'll call them straight away. She rummaged in a drawer for a card and then picked up the phone. That's funny, she said. The phone's dead too. Well, doesn't it need power? Claudia asked from over by the table. Our cordless one does. I'm not using the cordless, my mother said. This is the wired-in landline. Oh, shit. There was a heavy knock on the front door. I'll get it, said Claudia, turning away. The power was off. The telephone was dead. There was a knock on the front door, and the hairs on the back of my neck were suddenly standing bolt upright. Don't touch it! I shouted at Claudia. She turned to look at me, but she still moved towards the danger. Why ever not? She said. Claudia! I shouted in. Get away from the door! I was already halfway towards her when the knock was repeated, and still Claudia moved towards it. I grabbed her just as she was reaching for the handle. What on earth are you doing? She said loudly. Answer the bloody door! No! I said quietly. Why ever not? She demanded. Keep your voice down, I hissed at her. Why? She said, but much quieter, with concern. She could probably read the fear in my face. Please, just go over to the kitchen area. I looked over at my mother, who was staring at us, still holding the useless telephone in her hand. Something about the urgency of my voice finally got through to Claudia, and she went over to join my mother. They both suddenly looked rather frightened. I went into the small cloakroom next to the front door and peeked through a minute gap in the net curtains at the person standing outside.
He had on a grey-green anorak with the collar turned up, and this time he was wearing a dark blue baseball cap, but there was no doubt. It was the same man I had last seen in the grainy video from Mr. Patel's newsagents, the same man who had gunned down Herb Kovac at Aintree, and the same man who had shot at me in Litchfield Grove. Bugger, I thought, echoing my mother. I went back into the big room. The front door had locked automatically when it was closed, with a lock a bit like a Yale latch. It was quite strong, but was it strong enough? I went quickly across to the kitchen and locked the back door as well, turning the key slowly to keep the noise to a minimum, and sliding across the bolt at the top. Both my mother and Claudia watched my every step. We heard the man rattle the front door, and they both instinctively crouched down below the worktop. "Who is it?" whispered my mother. "I'd have to tell them." "Darlings," I whispered, "he's a very dangerous man, and he's trying to kill me." Claudia's eyes opened so wide I thought they would pop out of her head. My mother, however, thought I was joking, and began to laugh. "I'm being serious," I said, cutting her off in mid-guffaw. "It's the same man who killed Herb Kovac at Aintree Races." This time, they both looked more frightened than ever, and I was too. "Call the police," Claudia said, then she remembered. "Oh, my God, he's cut the phone line." And the electricity. The broadband connection would have failed with the power, and our mobiles didn't have any signal here. We were on our own. "Upstairs," I said quietly but firmly. "Both of you, now, lock yourselves in the bathroom, sit on the floor, and don't come out until I tell you to." Claudia hesitated a moment, but then she nodded and took my mother by the hand. They started to go, but then turned back. "But what are you going to do?" Claudia asked with huge fear in her face. "Try to keep him out," I said. "Now go on, go!" They disappeared up the boxed-in staircase, and I heard the bathroom door being shut and locked above me. And if he did get in and kill me, I thought, perhaps he'd leave them alone and go away, job done. As it was, with all three of us down here, I was sure he would have killed us all. I looked around for some sort of weapon. A loaded shotgun would have been nice, but my mother had about as much interest in country sports as I did in origami. I heard the back door being tried, and I instinctively ducked away from it. The sun went down, the last of its orange rays disappearing from the kitchen window, and it began to get dark, especially indoors with no electric lights to brighten the gathering gloom. I looked around in desperation for something to use as a weapon. An umbrella stood in a large china pot near the front door, and a walking stick. I grabbed the walking stick, but it was a collapsible model for ease of packing. So I opted for the umbrella, one of those big golf umbrellas with a heavy wooden handle. It wasn't much, but it was all there was. How I wished the cottage still had a proper open fire with a big heavy metal poker, but my mother had replaced it with one of those gas things with fake coals. But at least I had one advantage over my assailant insofar as I could see him more easily than he could see me. It was still quite light outside, and I watched him through the windows as he went right round the house. At one point, he came close to the kitchen window, cupping his hands round his face and up against the glass in order to peer in. I made sure I was standing to the side of the window in a dark corner, where he would have no chance of spotting me. Perhaps he would go away, I thought. He didn't. The sound of breaking glass put pay to any hope I may have had that this was going to end simply and without violence. My mother's windows were old, in keeping with the age of her cottage. They were a version of the old leaded lights, small panes of glass held together by a lattice framework of metal strips. The gunman had broken just one of the little panes in one of the kitchen windows, but it was enough for him to put his gloved hand through the opening and unlatch the whole thing. I watched him do it in the fading light, and the window swung open outwards. Where could I hide? Without doubt, the best place to be was in the bathroom upstairs with the door locked, but I had no intention of joining Claudia and my mother there. I was sure that that would lead, in the end, to the deaths of all three of us. So where else was there to hide? Nowhere. I concluded that hiding was, in fact, my least favoured option. It would simply give the advantage to the gunman, who could take his time all night if necessary, and eventually he would undoubtedly find me, and then I too would get a couple of bullets in my heart and another in my face, just as poor Herb had. So if I wasn't going to hide, and I certainly wasn't going to merely stand and wait to be killed, the only other option was to attack and attack hard and fast. He started to climb through the window, his gun with its long black silencer entering first. I just stood to the side of the window and raised the umbrella, holding it by the pointed end so that I could swing the heavy wooden handle. I used all my strength and brought the handle down hard onto the gun. I had actually been aiming for his wrist, but he pulled it back a fraction just at the last second. The gun went off, the bullet ricocheting off the granite worktop below the window with a loud zing before burying itself in the wall opposite. But the blow had also knocked the gun from the man's grasp.
It clattered to the floor, sliding across the stone quarry tiles and out of sight under my mother's old fridge. That evened things up a bit, I thought, but I would have loved to have been able to grab the gun and turn it on its owner.
Let me see!
The man said explosively. I didn't know what he meant, and it sadly didn't stop him coming through the window. I raised the umbrella for another strike, but he was wise to me now, and he grabbed it as it descended and tore it from my grasp, tossing it aside as he stepped right through the open window, crouching on the worktop. I rushed at him, but he was ready, pushing me aside with ease so that I stumbled across the kitchen towards the sink. I turned quickly, but the man had already jumped down to the floor. I watched him as he looked around, and then withdrew a large carving knife from the wooden block next to my mother's stove. Now, why hadn't I thought of that? I moved quickly to my right, putting the dining table between him and me. If he couldn't reach me, he couldn't stab me either. There followed a sort of ballet with him moving one way or the other, and me mirroring him, always keeping the table between us. Once we ran round and round the table three or four times, with me watching carefully for him to change direction. He pulled out chairs to try to slow me down, but I was quick. I may not be as fit as I was as a jockey, but I was still no slouch in the running department. It had fared me well in Lichfield Grove, and was doing so again here. But for how long? He only needed to get lucky once. He changed his tactics, using one of the chairs to climb up onto the table, and then he came straight at me across it. I turned and ran for the stairs, pulling open the latch door and bounding up the steps two or three at a time. I could hear him behind me, and he was gaining. Where could I go? I was running out of options. Panic began to rise in my throat. I didn't want to die. I turned to face him. At least I would see it coming, and I'd be able to make some effort to get away from the thrust of the knife. He stood at the top of the stairs with me just 4 feet away in front of him. He advanced a step and I retreated a step. Then we both repeated the drill, but my back was now up against the wall. I had no further to go. He came a step closer to me, and I readied myself for his strike, although what I would do when it came I didn't know. Die, probably. Claudia stepped out of the bathroom, just down the corridor to his right. "Fuck off, you bastard!" she shouted at him with full fortissimo. "Leave him alone!" She then slammed the bathroom door shut again and locked it. He turned momentarily towards the noise, and I leapt at him, wrapping my right arm round his neck with my forearm across his throat, while at the same time I tried to gouge his eyes out with the fingers of my left hand. I squeezed his neck with all my strength, but it was not enough. The man was considerably taller and stronger than I, and in spite of my best grip he simply began to turn himself round to face me, and with both of my arms held up around his head, my abdomen would be totally defenceless to a thrust of the knife. What had that spinal specialist told me? "Whatever you do," he said, "don't get into a fight." He'd said nothing about falling downstairs. I hung onto the man's neck as if my life depended on it, which it probably did, and then I dived, head first, down the narrow boxed-in stairway, taking the man down with me. It was a crazy thing to do, especially for someone who had precious little holding his head to his body, but it was my only chance. I twisted as we fell, so that I landed on top of the man, his head taking the full force of the heavy contact with the wall where the stairway turned through 90 degrees, halfway down. We slithered onto the bottom of the wooden stairs, coming to a halt, still locked together by my right arm, which I was still pulling as tightly as I could round his neck. We were lying, partially through the lever-latch doorway, our legs still on the stairs with our heads and torso sticking out into the room below. Even for me on top, and using the man's body to break my fall, the first impact with the wall had been enough to drive the air from my lungs. But at least my head hadn't fallen off with it. I pulled my arm from under his neck and jumped to my feet, ready to continue the fight. But there was no need. The man lay limply face down where he'd come to rest. I went quickly to fetch my mother's collapsible walking stick, and then I used it to retrieve the gun from beneath her fridge, hooking it out with the handle. If the man moved so much as an eyebrow, I thought I'd shoot him. I stood over him for what felt like a very long time, pointing the gun at his head and watching for any movement. But the man didn't move, not even to breathe. Nevertheless, I still didn't trust him not to jump up and kill me, so I kept the gun pointing at him all the time.
"Claudia!" I shouted as loudly as I could. "Claudia, I need your help!"
I heard the bathroom door being unlocked, and then footsteps on the floorboards above my head.
"Has he gone?"
Claudia asked from the top of the stairs. It was so dark that she couldn't even see the man lying right beneath her.
"I think he might be dead," I said. "But I'm taking no chances, and it's getting so dark I can hardly see him."
"I've got a torch by my bed," my mother said in a matter-of-fact tone. I heard her walk along the corridor to her room. Then she came back shining the torch brightly down the stairwell.
"Oh, my God," Claudia said, looking down.
In the torchlight, we could see that the man's head was lying almost flat against his right shoulder in a most unnatural position. The man's neck was clearly broken, just as mine had once been. But on this occasion, there were no friendly paramedics to apply an immobilizing collar, no one to save his life with prompt and gentle care as there had been for me at Cheltenham Racecourse all those years ago. This man's broken neck had bumped on down to the bottom of a wooden stairway, all the time being wrenched to one side by my arm. And it had killed him.